Okay. So I see a few more quizzes here if you haven't picked yours up, so you get a chance to pick up the quizzes. Very quickly, I forgot to make copies. I'm sorry of the start of the class test, but I'll put it online so you can download it. Today we're going to actually finish our discussion of growth and talk about the really big number in every discounted cash flow valuation, which is the terminal value. A number that scares a lot of people, hugely misunderstood, hugely misused. So I'm going to ask you some questions related to the terminal value that we'll come back to and talk about a little more today. Okay? Here's the first one. We've kind of talked around this. We might even have talked specifically about it. Okay? Terminal value is the number that we use to put closure on a discounted cash flow valuation. And I'm going to list four different ways in which you can estimate terminal value. And if you're doing an intrinsic valuation, I'd like you to tell me which of these four ways should never be used, ever, to get a terminal value. First is the liquidation value. Is it?
You should use the liquidation
value. Why?
Because the liquidation value is the value of if you took all the assets of the firm and sold them.
But what if that's the most realistic end game for your company?
You have to be able to, if that's the case, then you have to be able to forecast it however many years after.
But what if there are no more years? What if I have a royalty trust? You know what a royalty trust is? Basically, it's an oil reserve. I sell the oil from the ground, 15 years of oil. When the oil's all done, there's nothing left but this hole in the ground. Right? You're right. Liquidation value might not be the right way to value Coca-Cola, but if I gave you a finite life investment, and at the end of the investment, the cash flows end, and the project ends, and the company's wound up, liquidation value is a cash flow. It is an intrinsic cash flow. Right? So liquidation value might not be seen very often in discounted cash flow valuation, but it is consistent with intrinsic valuation if your company doesn't have life left at the end of the closure period. Stable growth model, obviously you see a lot of it, right? You ever seen a growing perpetuity model? I actually listed the equation when we did corporate finance. A growing annuity model is when you have a cash flow that will grow at X percent a year for 30 or 40 or 50 years. There's actually an equation that will give you that value. We almost never use it, but can we use that in an intrinsic valuation? Let's suppose I get to year 10, and I say, you know what, this company will keep going, but it's not going to go forever. It's in a technology which eventually is going to get wound up, maybe 30, 40, 50 years. It's using a growing annuity model consistent with an intrinsic valuation. Again, why should companies go forever? In fact, you could argue growing perpetuity is the unrealistic assumption. All I'm saying is we get caught up in this growing perpetuity equation as the only way to compute terminal value. It might not be. Liquidation value is okay. A growing annuity is okay if that's the way your company is structured. I've kind of given away the answer. It's the only way you should never compute terminal value? Applying a multiple. And here's the tragedy. Almost every investment banking valuation, the terminal value comes from using a multiple. 6 times EBITDA, 5 times earning, 2 times revenues, you name it. Right? If you do that, please don't call this a discounted cash flow valuation. It's a discounted cash flow valuation in drag. The drag component is the cash flows. While I'm distracted by the cash flows, you slip in 6 times EBITDA, which you got how? By looking at what other companies in the space trade at now, which is a pricing and a multiple. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a forward pricing, but it's not an intrinsic valuation. So when you see discounted cash flow valuations, the biggest number comes from using a multiple obtained by looking at companies trading today. It is really not an intrinsic valuation. So let's assume that you decide to go the perpetual growth rate. Joseph.
Sorry, just to clarify. So yep. You're saying you can use the exit multiple, but that just makes it not intrinsic.
Exactly. Okay. It's a relative valuation. There's nothing wrong with that, right? So if you use 15 times earnings to get the value 5 years from now, that's fine. You're doing a pricing. You're just doing a forward pricing rather than a current pricing.
But for the forecast period, we're still using the intrinsic.
The forecast period is kind of a non-player in the game, right? Because that's why I said it's really a pricing and drag, because what you have in the front are the cash flows. The cash flows look like they matter, but they really don't because it's all coming from that multiple. It's just a way in which you slip in a pricing and make a claim that it's an intrinsic valuation. Now let's assume you decide to go the perpetual growth route, right? So let's make this very simple. Let's assume that you are doing an intrinsic valuation and you decide that this company has $100 million in after-tax operating income and cash flow every year forever with no growth. Let's keep it simple. Let's assume this company has a cost of capital of 10%. What's the terminal value? What kind of cash flow is this? $100 million every year forever is a perpetuity, right? What's the present value of a perpetuity? It's, guys, come on. You're 4 months away from graduating, right? The present value of a perpetuity is the cash flow divided by the discount rate, right? Which is 100 divided by 0.10, which is $1 billion. Let's say you're not happy. It's too low. What if I told you this company will grow at 2% a year forever? Remember the terminal value you got in the previous page? This sounds like a slam dunk answer, but go along with me. Will the terminal value go up, go down, not change? Any of the above? Actually, it cannot be none of the above because it's got to be one of the three. So let's leave it at the four plausible answers, right? Because if you say none of the above, then we're into the one of those math territories as the numbers. Remember that those math classes with math professor would talk about numbers that don't exist, and you'd go wrap your head around that concept. Right? So increase, decrease, no change, or any of the above. Go with what seems like the obvious answer. It'll increase, right? In fact, if I ask you mathematically what the answer is, what do? You take the... it's now a growing perpetuity, so what do? You take the 100 million divided by 0.10 divided by minus 0.02, which is 1.25 billion. This is magic. I just increase the terminal value by 250 million. If I make the growth rate 6%, it becomes 2 billion. If I make it 6%, it becomes 3 billion. This is how you can really... you could talk about value enhancement right there, right? What am I missing when I... There must be something I'm missing with... No, the discount rate is still the same business. You're growing in the same business, Rajiv. In other words, what's in my numerator? In the previous example, I said your after-tax operating income is also your cash flow. And why was I able to do that? What's your growth rate? Zero. If you have a growth rate of zero, how much do you need to reinvest? Nothing. So the reason I was able to assume my earnings were equal to my cash flows is because I had no growth. Now, what have I done? I've thrown growth into the equation, right? That's a good thing, but that growth has to come from somewhere. You're saying efficiency. It's not going to work. Why? Because it's forever. So what has to happen? You have to reinvest. How much? What does it depend on? What's the intrinsic equation for growth? Return on capital times reinvestment rate, right? So if you do a little algebra... If I tell you the growth rate is 2%, your reinvestment rate is going to be a function of what your return on capital is. Let's try one. Let's say the return on capital is exactly 10%. How much would you need to reinvest to get to a 2% growth rate? 2% is my growth rate. 10% is my return on capital. My reinvestment rate, therefore, has to be 0.2 or 20%, right? So let's say if you took 100 million, you took out 20%, you're going to end up with 80 million in cash flows. 80 million divided by 0.10 minus 0.02 is 1 billion. I thought growth was good. Nothing happened. You think, what if I try 4% growth? If you try a 4% growth, 40% of my 100 million leaves, so my cash flow becomes 60 million. 60 divided by 0.06 is still a billion. So the value doesn't change when growth changes. What did I just assume that led my terminal value to stay unchanged? In other words, my return on capital is equal to my cost of capital. Think in capital budgeting terms. If you take a project that earns exactly the cost of capital, what's your net present value for the project? It's zero. What happens to your company if you take a project with a net present value of zero? Nothing. What if you take 100 projects with a net present value of zero? Nothing. 1,000, nothing. If you get that, you crack the code on what drives terminal value. The terminal value is not driven by what you assume about growth. It's what you assume about excess returns in perpetuity that drive your terminal value. If you assume that you earn exactly your cost of capital, it doesn't matter what the growth rate is. So the next time somebody tells you, oh, that terminal value equation is so, you know, oh, I can change the growth rate. Look how much it changes. They're not getting it. You can't just change the growth rate. This isn't some math game. This is a real business. If you change the growth rate, you have to think through the consequences of what will it mean in terms of reinvestment, what will it mean in terms of cash flows, and will my value go up? And the only scenario where your terminal value is going to go up is if your return on capital forever is greater than your cost of capital. In fact, if you have a business that earns less than its cost of capital, if you increase the growth rate in your terminal value, you'll actually lower the terminal value. You can add value, do nothing to value, or destroy value. So the right answer here is any of the above. Of course, you've got to cross out the none of the above. Any of the above, it will increase depending on what you assume about return on capital in perpetuity. So that's the message I'm going to try to reinforce today, because if you get that, you can basically break down terminal value. Jordan?
A slight tangent has to do with reinvestment.
Right.
Right. If you take technology that's constantly getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, isn't it plausible that you could have a company that's getting more and more out of cheaper?
Let me ask you a question. Is it getting cheaper and cheaper just for you, or is it getting cheaper and cheaper for everybody in your space?
Everybody.
Okay. Do you know what's going to happen next, right? The prices you charge your consumers. In a sense, if it got cheaper and cheaper just for you and everybody else lived in a world where costs were increasing, that's a huge competitive advantage. You can then charge the same prices as everybody else and walk away with this huge profit. A benefit that accrues to everybody is a benefit that accrues to nobody. And that's, I think, part of the problem is when you hear stories like, you know, this company, you know, what happens if this, you have to kind of add to that story and say it happens only to this company, not to the rest of the space. So what happens in the technology space is your costs of your inputs keep going down, but your output price also will go down because competition will keep pushing that down.
What if you're not a technology company? What if you're like an internet service company that utilizes technology?
Same process, right? Unless it's something unique to you, there's going to be a price war that's coming sooner or later. And it happens in every one of these businesses where you have an underlying economics that's driving the cost of your inputs down. The cost of your the price that you charge for your output also goes down. So everybody ends up, in a sense, in the same position they were before the cost structure started imploding on you. So you got to look for other edges to kind of to get that gain on return on capital.
So in evaluation, you really couldn't have a situation where CapEx and depreciation
ever. With no, let me take that back. I mean, in fact, let me ask the broaden Jordan's question. His question was, in evaluation, can CapEx converge on depreciation? Can I set net CapEx to zero? I can if I assume, what about growth? Zero growth. If you give me that growth, you can make CapEx. What I can't let happen is for you to keep telling me that operating income will keep growing up, going up 2% a year, but that you will have no reinvestment to go with it. Because mathematically, the company will blow up on you. Your return on capital will go to infinity.
Couldn't that also depend on your assumptions built into depreciation, like useful life and things like that?
Yeah, again, don't get caught up in the accounting depreciation number. The question we're asking is, can I keep generating more income with the same asset base, the same invested capital in my asset base? And the answer has to be no, because if I can keep generating more income from, then this is a goldmine business, and unless I can find a way to keep everybody else up. So the only scenario you can get away with that is if the government somehow grants me a monopoly, lets me charge whatever price I want, while having the economics of the business kind of work in my favor for the rest of eternity. And if that's the case, then of course that company should be worth almost an infinite amount of money, because that's a money machine, right? Okay. And that's why it's so difficult to think of a scenario. I mean, every year I try to think of it. Perhaps this outlandish example of a company that can grow in perpetuity without reinvesting. Every time I try, I run into a brick wall. Somewhere along the way, the logic breaks down because it's very difficult to make that argument and carry it to its logic. I mean, you almost have to be in a world where only your company moves and everybody else is kind of static, because if everybody's moving, your advantages will start dissipating. Right? Any other questions? Yes. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if you make that assumption, then terminal value, the growth doesn't matter. If you choose to make a different assumption, then have a good reason for it. Tell me a story about competitive advantage in the long term. It doesn't make your reinvestment go to zero. It means you can reinvest less to deliver the same growth rate. So if you have a brand name company where you say brand name is this huge, long-standing competitive advantage, it's going to last 100 years. I'm valuing Campbell's Soup or Coca-Cola. I'm going to leave the return on capital above the cost of capital even after I get to year 10. I'm okay with that. But then your reinvestment rate will then reflect that higher return on capital you're getting. You will get a benefit from growth in perpetuity. But that benefit is not unbounded, right? You still have a reinvestment you got to bring in. Every time I grow a little faster, I will increase that value. But there is a cap to that growth rate because it's forever. It cannot be higher than your risk-free rate. That cap can't disappear. So we'll talk about constraints we're going to put on the terminal value that keep it from running away from you. Because if it runs away from you, you've lost control of your DCF. Right? Yes? Are you doing an analysis in nominal terms, or are you doing them in real terms? Okay, so your growth is at the inflation rate. And you have to reinvest to keep your existing capacity at, so your capacity stays fixed. But your old machines have to get replaced with new machines when they run out, right? Inflation helped you on the price level. When you replace your machines, wouldn't you have to pay more as well? In other words, you can't draw on the inflation on the revenue side and say it doesn't happen in the cost side, because that would be like this great company. If you can pull it off, all the more power to you. But if everybody in your sector has that benefit, your prices are going to start to come down. You're going to start to see that in your margins and your revenues.
So you should reflect it in the cash flow.
What I'm trying to say, this is perhaps categorical. I'm almost never this dogmatic about anything. If you have growth in your terminal value, then you have to have reinvestment. Now, if you assume a high return on capital, I can live with that if you can justify that high return on capital. Okay? So that's the message I hope to deliver. It's not that everybody has to earn a return on capital equal to the cost of capital. That's too dogmatic for me. But if you assume perpetual growth, I want to see how you deliver that growth. Because if I don't make you think about that, then growth becomes this mathematical number that you just change and move towards your cost of capital, and your terminal value just explodes out on you. So let's pick up where we left off on Wednesday. We were talking about growth, and we were talking about how to estimate growth using fundamentals, right? And reviewing very quickly, every single approach that we talked about depended on two things. How much are you reinvesting? How well are you reinvesting? So Christy, help me out again. When we talked about how much you're reinvesting, how do we measure that? How did we measure the reinvestment rate? What did we do? We took the net capex plus change in working capital and divided by the earnings, right? And we measured how well you reinvested. Joseph, we took the earnings and divided by the invested capital, book value of equity. But both those measures worked only because we had positive earnings, right? If you have negative earnings, we see already how these approaches are going to break down. Because if you have negative earnings, what's your reinvestment rate going to look like? You take your reinvestment divided by negative number. It's negative. Your return on capital will be negative number, will be negative. You think this is very convenient. Negative times negative is positive. But if you take a negative number and you grow it at a positive rate, I know this sounds incredibly convoluted. Negative number growing is going to become a more negative number. What I'm trying to say is the normal way we get out of a problem when you're valuing companies, the value is too low, is we use a higher growth rate. That no longer works if you're losing money. And that's at the core of why we run into trouble with money-losing companies, because we're trained to play with the growth rate and it's not working. So one easy way out is to replace a negative number with a positive number, right? Which is what we do when we normalize numbers, when we replace the negative earnings. But let's look at the more difficult scenario. What if you're valuing a young startup or an infrastructure company that's building toll roads? It's got negative earnings, not because it's a badly managed, badly run company, but because of where it is in the process, right? So your task is to make the negative earnings into positive earnings. You also want to make sure that as you're doing this, you're taking into account the fact that these companies still have to grow. They grow their revenues rather than the operating income. And to create that growth, they have to reinvest. So all the rules we talked about still apply, but we no longer have that nice, neat equation to use to compute how much you reinvest. So I'm going to suggest a three-step process. And this is a process I follow repeatedly when I value young startups, but pretty much with any company. When you have a negative number in your earnings, keep moving up the income statement till you hit a positive number. Sounds like desperation time, but it is desperation time, right? And often the first positive number you're going to hit is revenues. Good. We have something to work with now, right? So we start with revenues, and we grow revenues first. Top line growth. Why? Because if you have negative earnings, that's where you got to go with top line growth. So you got small revenues going into big revenues. Second stop. What do you have right now? You're losing money, right? You have negative margins. I know this sounds incredibly simplistic, but you got to make those negative margins into positive margins. So the second big number you're going to focus on is, what's my target margin going to be? What margin do I think my company can earn, assuming it turns a corner and becomes a healthy company? Now, that's a tough number. I'm not saying it's easy, but that number has to be estimated. And you, in a sense, have to coax your company from where it is today, losing money, to that money-making entity. So you've got to make negative margins into positive margins. If you think about your model now, you have revenues now going from small to big numbers. Your negative margins have become positive margins. You're almost there. You now have positive earnings. Then I'm going to ask you a third question. You made your small revenues into big revenues. You had revenue growth. Did you reinvest enough to sustain it? Because just like everywhere else, to grow, you have to reinvest. And here I'm going to introduce a ratio you might not have seen so far. It's called the sales to capital ratio. What it is revenue divided by invested capital. The way to think about this is, how much additional revenue do I get for every dollar of additional capital I put into this business? The higher that number, the more efficiently you're delivering revenues. So if you're in a business like technology, you might say, I can deliver $6 of revenues for every dollar of capital. If you're in the auto business, you'd be lucky to get $1.50 in revenue for $1.50 in revenue for every dollar in capital. You're saying, how's that going to help me? It's actually very simple. I'm going to take the change in revenue every year. I'm going to use the sales to capital ratio to figure out how much you would have had to reinvest in that year. And that's going to become my reinvestment. Net capex and change in working capital are all consolidated in the number. So three-step process. Revenue growth makes small revenues into big revenues. The target margin makes your negative earnings into positive earnings. The sales to capital ratio allows you to estimate the reinvestment every year. You're saying, why don't you just use capex, depreciation, and working capital from last year? You take a young startup. You look at capex, depreciation, and working capital last year. You might as well have not looked at it. It's a completely noisy, useless number because there's not much there. So the more you can tie things to your revenues, the better off you are, because that's going to be the driver for growth, is you have to start with revenue growth and work down. So I'm going to take an example. This is way back in time. In fact, these numbers look hopelessly optimistic in hindsight. But this was when Sirius had bought XM Radio, and the whole world looked like it was in front of them. Everybody was going to have satellite radio in their cars, and this was the future. So I'll plead guilty to the numbers being over-optimistic, but actually with the numbers I got, my estimates, I actually ended up with a value which was one half of the market price. So if I was being optimistic, the market was being twice as optimistic. So I'll take you through the process. Here's what Sirius looked like when I sat down to value them. They had $187 million in revenues. Tiny revenues, and an operating loss of $787 million. We are in trouble, right? Your operating loss is almost four times your entire revenue. So there, and it's not surprising why that was, because they were spending the money on infrastructure to kind of set up for future growth, and it was showing up as losses. My task is laid out for me, right? To value Sirius, first step is I've got to make the small revenues and big revenues. So here's what I did. I projected out revenues of about $9 billion in 10 years. You're saying, how do you come up with $9 billion? Their revenues came primarily from advertising. So I looked at the entire radio advertising market. I looked at the big players. I tried to decide, and this was my judgment, on what portion of the market would end up with Sirius. That $9.035 billion reflects the collection of subscription revenues and advertising revenues that would become their base. You're saying, but that's an estimate. Of course, it's an estimate. You think there's somebody out there including somebody at Sirius who actually has these numbers in an envelope somewhere, and they know what... Nobody knows. It's your estimate versus somebody else's. What I'm trying to say is be willing to be wrong, because if you're not willing to be wrong, you will never get started on valuing these companies. Get started, and then you can come back, circle back, and say, maybe that number was too high. So I'm essentially making small revenues into big revenues. I've made the small company. So one-third of my problem is now solved. I've made the company into a big company, at least in my spreadsheet. I've got a second really big problem, right? Minus 420% operating margin. If that stays at minus 420%, I know exactly what the company's worth. It's worth nothing. It's going to go out of business. So I spent some time trying to get this number, and I'm not sure I got the right number. I want to get a sense of what the operating margin is going to look like for Sirius once it gets to steady state. I know it's going to lose money next year, 2 years out, maybe even 5 years out. So the second step in the process is I projected a target margin. And here I use the margins of the largest players in this business. Clear Channel, in fact, is the biggest player. Its margin is close to 20%. I assume that they would converge on 20%. So you can see assumptions are piling on top of assumptions. But I've got to keep moving. Otherwise, I'm not going to get to the end of the value. So my operating margin goes from minus 420 to plus 19.6%. So how do you come up with the middle numbers? I actually used a very simple algorithm. See if you can figure out what it is. How did I get from minus 420 to minus... Notice second decimal point? I must be doing something spectacularly precise, right? It was a very simplistic algorithm as to how I got from year 0 to year 1, year 1 to year 2. What do I think? It's actually a step, but it's actually a preset step. So the spreadsheet actually filled out the 10 years. Where am I right now? Minus 420, right? Where do I want to be? Plus 20. What's the distance between the two? 440, right? I divided by 2. I told you it was simplistic. 440 divided by 2 is a 220% improvement. There's my improvement in year 1. Now I'm at minus 200. I want to be at plus 20. What's the distance? 220. I took half the distance. So each year, all I'm doing is taking the half. You're saying, why half? Why not? In fact, in this spreadsheet, I set it to half because I feel optimistic that margins will improve fairly quickly, and then I let you change it. Change it in what sense? The essence of valuation is that when you disagree with me, I have to show you the number that you can show your disagreement in. So let's say you came to me and said, you know what, you're being way too optimistic about the pathway to profitability. That's what this is, right? It's going to be a lot more rocky. Then my suggestion to you is make the half into a quarter. You know what that's going to do? I'm going to still end up at plus 20, but I'm going to lose a lot more money for a longer period. When you do these valuations of small companies, you have to keep the doors open to your input. So if somebody says, you are wrong about that, you're not scrambling. So what do I change here? So if somebody, I don't know this business. Somebody says, you're being way too optimistic that this business will improve that much. I'll make the half into a quarter. I'll still lose money, but I'll lose money for a longer period, and I will lose more money for the earlier years. The last thing I want to be doing with a company like Sirius, like Uber, is sitting there in year 3 asking, what will the operating margin be in year 3? Because I know exactly what that'll cause. It'll cause my hair to fall out. It'll cause me to freak out, and I'll stop doing the valuation. So I want to keep my eyes on that end game here. The end game is, this is the number that I'm most worried about, the 19.57. The middle numbers have a much lesser impact on value, and I'm willing to concede them to you. If you made a stand and said, I think the improvement is going to be one-third or one-quarter, I said, take it. The effect on value is going to be relatively small. So if you look at my last column, that is my operating loss by year. And you can see initially I'm expecting it to actually get worse before it gets better. Why? Because they're growing fast. And as they grow fast, the losses kind of explode out on you. As the margin improves, the operating loss becomes an operating profit. So my revenues come first. My margin comes next. What's the one thing I haven't dealt with yet? This revenue going from 187 to 9 billion is going to take some reinvestment, right? So here's the last piece of the puzzle. I took the change in revenue every year based on my revenue growth. In this sector, if you look at the sector, it's a pretty infrastructure heavy sector. The sales to invested capital ratio is $1.50. Which means for every $1.15 additional revenues, it would look like businesses are reinvesting about a dollar. See what I'm going to do with that? In year one, to get the additional revenue of $375 million, you divide by 1.50, there's my reinvestment in year one. So each year, I'm taking the change in revenue in that year and dividing by my sales to invested capital ratio. And this is why I said if you have a high sales to invested capital ratio, that's an advantage because it means you can get more revenue for less reinvestment. Jordan. In fact, I've heard arguments in both sides, which is there are people who say, well, initially, won't you get the maybe in some sectors, you might actually be able to get more revenues with relatively little reinvestment, but as the business gets more competitive, like Uber, you might actually see it decreasing. Or you might have low upfront, high. The question I'm asking is, why is it 1.5 every year? It doesn't have to be. If you have enough information to finesse it and say large companies have much, so within the sector, look across companies. Maybe there are differences in sales to invested capital by size of the business. And you can use that then to have different numbers as you go through time. So that approach of using sales to capital is kind of flexible enough to allow you to change numbers as you go along to reflect economies of scale or whatever else you think will happen within the business. Yes. It's the same definition that we use for return on invested capital, right? Which is what? Debt plus equity minus cash. Never ever, when you are asked to do invested capital, and this is just my personal view, don't go with the asset side of the balance sheet. You will get into trouble. Do you see what I mean by the asset side of the balance sheet? You start with plant and equipment, and then you say, what do I do with goodwill? You're going to run into all these roadblocks. You say, oh my God, what do we do next? Whereas if you go with the debt plus equity minus cash, it's far simpler, it's far more consistent, but it's all book value. Book value debt plus book value equity minus cash. So that's what the invested capital is.
What is the logic for using the value?
Because when you do return on capital, which is the analog when you have a mature company, it's based on book value as well, because that's what you put into your business. If you have a great business, you can invest 100 and get back 350. So it measures the efficiency of your investment. So if you can get great growth with relatively little reinvestment, the only way I can show that is by allowing you to use book value when you do reinvestment. Okay? If you're in a business where return on capital is equal to cost of capital, guess what's going to happen? Then the book value is going to converge on market value. You're going to gain nothing from this additional growth, and things are going to start to dissipate under you. Okay? So three big numbers, revenue growth, target margin, sales, invested capital. And if you look at most of my valuations online, they rest on those three big numbers. And I want them to rest on three numbers rather than 35 numbers, because then you can say, I don't like that number, I like that number, I don't like that number. That way you can focus on what you can change and see the effect on your valuation. Okay? So revenue growth measures your growth potential. The target margin measures your profitability potential. Your sales to capital ratio measures the quality of your reinvestment or the quality of your growth, which are basically the same thing. Now, one of the nice things about doing a discounted cash flow valuation is as you create this company on your spreadsheet, and it's really, I mean, you're playing God, right? You're essentially taking a small company and making it this huge profitable company. You could, at least should stop and ask the question, am I comfortable with the company I am creating on my own spreadsheet? Do you see what I mean by that? Because it's easy to get carried away. You can create some astronomically wonderful companies on your spreadsheet without even thinking about it. So one thing I do to kind of keep myself, I won't say honest because I'm not that honest, but at least to be accountable to myself, is I take that reinvestment, which we think about in free cash flows, that what you take out of your earnings to get to cash flows. But that reinvestment actually serves another purpose because it's book value. It's also the change in your invested capital as a company on a year-to-year basis. Do you see where I'm going with this? If you take Sirius, they had invested capital on their books of $1.657 billion at the start of the period. So the book value of equity plus book value of debt minus cash for Sirius at the start. Each year that I reinvest, it adds on to that capital invested. So I can keep track of that. And because I'm assuming an operating income from the margin, I can divide my estimate of the operating margin with my estimate of the invested capital in this company. I think of it as an imputed return on capital that I'm assuming for the company. You're saying, what do you plan to do with it? See that 15.81% in year 10? I have to be comfortable with that if I want this valuation to stand. If I look at that 15.81% and said, you know what, that's way too high, my spreadsheet is sending a message to me saying, go do something about it. Because I created this. This isn't some company that's been, you know, thrust upon me. This is a company I created. I have to be okay with my own creation. If I've created a Frankenstein, this is my last chance to kill it before it comes to life. I was okay with the 15.81%. The reason I was okay is I looked again at Clear Channel and the other companies in the sector, and the return on capital in the sector was roughly 16%. And I said, you know what? 15.81% is a pretty good return on capital. But in this business, because infrastructure is so expensive and difficult, but there's always a flip side to a negative, right? The negative in a toll road or an infrastructure company is what? You have to reinvest a lot to get into the business. What's a positive? You have to reinvest a lot to get into the business. You see how this is going to help you later down the road? Is when you get to year 10 or year 15, you make this company a steady state company, you can draw on that and say it's going to be difficult for others to enter the company. I mean, a week and a half ago when I took technology companies and I broke them down by age on my web, on my blog, I actually broke, and only one in five technology companies is less than 10. It's an aging sector. There are about 40% of all technology companies are older than 25 years. You think that's not that long? I mean, I describe this as technology companies age in dog years. That a 25-year-old technology company is like a 75-year-old consumer product company. Okay? And the life cycles of technology companies are short, much shorter. They're more intense. They grow faster. They grow quicker than most manufacturing companies because they don't need that capital investment. They can grow with they can scale up easily. That's an advantage, right? But you know what makes it a disadvantage? Is they can, other companies can also scale up quickly, which is the reason they can't last for as long as building an AT&T 100 years ago did. So in this case, that's effectively what this imputed return on capital is saying is, hey, are you okay with this? Let's say this had been 158%. It's too high, right? So what's the number I would go change if I end up with too high a return on capital in year 10? Why am I ending up with too high a return on capital? I'm not reinvesting enough, right? What's the number that gives me my reinvestment? My sales to capital ratio. If I make the 1.5 into 1.2, my return on capital is going to decrease. There's a feedback loop in your DCF that it makes sense for you to watch because it tells you, hey, maybe you've been too optimistic about reinvestment or not optimistic enough. And the way to see that feedback loop is by keeping track of that return on capital over time. Any questions? So let's bring all of these different growth measures into one picture. Okay? So the first thing to ask when you sit down to estimate growth is, what am I estimating growth in? Is it growth in earnings or is it growth in operating income? If it's growth in equity earnings, you can always take the lazy way out and look at what analysts are projecting as growth with all the baggage that comes with it. You can go with historical growth, which is really makes your valuation into a modeling exercise, or you can do fundamentals. If you decide to go the fundamental route with the equity earnings, you have to decide whether you're going to focus on earnings per share or net income. If it's earnings per share with stable return on equity, you're going to do the retention ratio times return equity. If it's a changing return equity, you have the deficiency component. If you do net income with stable return equity, all you do is replace retention ratio with the equity reinvestment rate. Reminder again, all that's different is an equity reinvestment rate is not capped at 100% and floored at zero. It can be more than 100 or less than zero. And the same thing with operating income. If you have negative earnings, three-step process: revenue growth, target margin, sales to invested capital. If you're clear about your pathway when you sit down to value a company, you're not going to be, because I think one of the reasons is people think that by having 16 different estimates of growth, so they think, let me take the analyst estimate, historical growth, let me all throw it all in a pot, I'm going to end up with a better estimate. That's not the best way to estimate growth. Choose a path and take your process all the way down that path to come up with an estimate of growth that you're comfortable with. Then use the feedback loop in your own valuation to decide whether you're okay with your own assumptions. Any questions about growth? Can you have a company with negative growth? Sure. Maybe negative growth. You might have negative reinvestment rate. So what does that mean? You're shrinking your company. You're liquidating your company every year. That's okay. In fact, there are many companies where I wish that happened, right? Because basically, the company's worth more as a smaller company rather than a bigger company. So leave open that door that your expected growth rate can, in fact, be a negative number. Yes, Rick?
Do you ever make assumptions about changing tax rates?
You could, and it's, in fact, a fairly simple assumption to bring in, right? Because it's the end of the game. So when I project margins, I always do pre-tax operating margins. Okay? That way I can leave open the door that tax rates can be different. I'll tell you one reason. It doesn't even have to be a change in the tax code. It can be changing geographical mix of your revenues, right? So if you're telling me more of your revenues come from Asia, that has consequences for my tax rate. So do everything on a pre-tax basis. Bring in the tax rate at the end of the game. And as with everything else, you can make your judgment calls on whether that number should be a fixed number, a number from last year, or a number that you think will be very different in the future. Okay. So now let's talk about the terminal value. Big number, of course. And in fact, we need it because without it, we're kind of sunk, right? Because the company can go on forever. This is your way of putting closure. That's what a terminal value does. And as we said earlier, while there are different ways, the one way that should never be used in a terminal value calculation is using a multiple. If you're doing an intrinsic valuation, you can do liquidation value, you can do a stable growth model, either in perpetuity or for a finite time period. Okay? When I value private businesses, I tend to use liquidation value to value businesses. Because many private businesses, it's really unrealistic to assume that this business will go on forever. It's usually the life of the lease. You own a store. When the lease ends, the business might end. So leave open that door again of liquidation value. Don't shut it that quickly because there might be some businesses where you're better off valuing based on a liquidation value rather than making assumptions about perpetuities. So let's talk about the rules that you need to follow to make sure your terminal value doesn't run away from you. So if you follow these four rules, I promise you, you will control your terminal value. Doesn't mean you're always going to be comfortable with the number, but you will at least know what's driving your number where it is. First, assuming you go with the growing perpetuity model, remember that that growth rate has to be less than or equal to the growth rate of the economy in which you operate, which means that that number is going to be a function of the inflation of the currency you decide to do the valuation in, because higher inflation currencies, you'll have a little more leeway. It'll also reflect the assumptions you're making about whether this company is going to stay a local company or a global company, because that might affect the growth rate. In fact, I've introduced this rule before, but I will introduce it again in the context of terminal value. When you get your terminal value, use your risk-free rate as a cap on your growth rate in perpetuity. That's really bad news for you in U.S. dollar terms or euro terms right now, right? Because what have I just said? That your growth rate today, if you're doing a valuation in U.S. dollars, cannot exceed what? What's the T-bond rate right now? 2.25%? It actually went up a fair amount on Friday. 2.25%? You're saying, that's terrible. If you're doing it in euros, just be glad you're not doing it in euros, right? In euros, what's your... It's going to be about 0.5%. You're saying, that's awful. That's so pessimistic. You know why I'm forcing you to be pessimistic with your growth rate? Did that 0.5% help you elsewhere in evaluation? When you did your cost of capital, you were celebrating the 0.5%. Look, I've got such a low risk-free rate. And I said, wonderful. No, keep your risk-free rate. I'll come back and hold you accountable somewhere else. What will kill your valuations if you leave the risk-free rate at 0.5% and decide to use a 3% nominal growth rate in your numerator, because that's what Europe has grown at historically. That, I promise you, will deliver too high a value for your company, because in a sense, you've made incompatible assumptions within your own valuation. So if somebody asks you, why should the risk-free rate have anything to do with the nominal growth rate? You can give them the long, drawn-out economic answer, which is the risk-free rate is expected inflation plus an expected real interest rate, and the growth rate in the economy is expected inflation plus an expected real growth rate. But there's a simpler explanation, which is if you're helped by one, you've got to kind of cut back on the other. So the low risk-free rate is helping you on the discount rate. And this is why earlier when you talked about risk-free rates, I said, don't try to normalize the risk-free rate. I'll give you a way to kind of keep things in sync. This is my way of keeping things in sync, is by setting the growth rate at less than or equal to the risk-free rate. And just be glad you're not doing things in Danish krone, right? You heard about in Denmark what's happened? If you borrow money in Denmark, this is almost so mind-boggling, you can't even wrap your head around it. The bank sends you a check every month. You borrow money, they send you a check every month. You lend money, you send a check out to the guy you lend money to. This, there's something fundamentally wrong with this process, right? Hey. The risk-free rate in Denmark is less than zero. I don't even know what to make of it. But it means I don't value a Danish company. I better factor that in somewhere in the way. And that basically will show up both as a lower discount rate and a much lower growth rate. So keep that as a cap. But that's a cap. It doesn't mean every company has to grow at 2.25%, right? Your company can grow at 2, it can grow at 1, it can grow at half. Can it grow at 0% a year forever? Can it grow at minus 1% a year forever? What happens to a cash flow if I set the growth rate at minus 1% a year forever? So it peaks in your terminal year, and then it gets smaller and smaller and effectively disappears, right? Which is actually the way life cycles look in practice. So leave open the possibility that your company might be that the company that actually has negative growth rate in perpetuity. It's okay. You can have minus 1% growth forever or minus 2% growth forever after year 5. It essentially is a way of saying my company peaks in my terminal year and then gets smaller. So that's the first rule. Any questions on that? So make sure your growth rate does not exceed your risk-free rate. Yes? Let's pause there. When you say improve your business, where does it show up for a mature company first? It'll show as a higher return on capital. So that's a higher return on capital story. If that's the story you're saying, even if you assume it's a permanent higher return on capital, the way it's going to show up is with that same growth rate now, you will get a much lower reinvestment rate. You will still reward these companies, but the way the reward is going to manifest itself is not by giving them a higher growth rate, but by giving them a lower reinvestment rate and a higher terminal value. If you believe that that higher return on capital will lead them to reinvest more and grow faster, then give them a growth period. So what that'll mean is you've introduced a growth period for mature companies that might otherwise have been mature companies already. So you have the levers under your control. It doesn't have to show up as your G in your terminal value. It can show up as a longer growth period, a higher return on capital, lower. There are lots of places we can reward companies if we believe that the lower risk-free rate is helping them.
I just want to put it as a temporary help.
That's right. That's a high growth period, right? So basically, all that means is you will have a five-year window or a three-year window. Whatever your QE window will become a high growth period. The only note I would add is what Jordan raised yesterday, which is if you have low risk-free rates, you're not the only one. Your competitors are getting it. And my fear is you could be building these high growth periods for every company when, in fact, collectively, companies are all borrowing at the lower rate. They're reinvesting all at this, what they think is this better return on capital. They all produce more stuff, and then they look around and say, who's going to buy all this stuff? So that's, I think, one of the concerns I have with giving companies this little bonus from lower risk-free rates, is we all partake in those lower risk-free rates. Okay? And that, I think, will mean that the benefits are going to be a lot smaller than we think they are collectively for companies. So any other questions on, so if you pick a higher inflation currency, will get more leeway in your growth rate, but your cost of capital also be higher? Yeah.
What if the U.S. company, which has 2% of risk-free rate, generated revenue, 9% of revenue in the U.S. market?
So tell me what your concern is with you. So your growth in that emerging market currency will be higher. So what do you have to do then to do a dollar valuation? Convert it back into... So the first thing is, if it's a pure inflation difference, it's driving the growth rate. Your exchange rate has to change for it, right? If it's real growth that you're getting in Asia, then you have to do what I suggested earlier. Give them a growth period. So if you believe that Coca-Cola gets a new lease of life because it's entering Asia, The way to reflect that is by giving them a growth window where they grow faster because they're growing in Asia. But after that, there is no benefit you get from having higher inflation currencies delivering more of your growth rate, because by the time you convert it back into the domestic currency in which you're doing the valuation, that benefit will disappear. So if you have higher growth in emerging markets and it's higher real growth, give them a higher growth window. Don't put them in terminal value yet. Okay? But once that growth is ended, the rule still applies. Okay. Any other questions? So that's the first rule. Here's the second one. Don't wait too long to put your company into stable growth. What's too long? I'm obviously talking, you know, 25-year, 30-year windows. It's almost mind-bogglingly long. I have never done a discounted cash flow valuation with longer than a 10-year growth window. So play devil's advocate. He's saying, but there are companies that have grown for longer than 10 years, right? So name them. Microsoft, IBM, Google. Then think about it. Why are we able to name these companies? Because they're the exception rather than the rule, right? You don't ever want to value a company to be the exception right from the start, because then what's your upside? I mean, the analogy I would give is some guy who runs into center field, 21-year-old runs into center field in Yankee Stadium. He said, that's the next Mickey Mantle. Hey, you're setting yourself for 15 years of disappointment, right? Your best case scenario is he's Mickey Mantle. And you say, well, I told you so. No surprises here. You can't value a company to be the next Google. Let me take it back. You can value a company as if it's the next Google and invest in it on that basis, but then pray and hope that it is the next Google, because everything beyond that will now be a negative surprise. So when you think about growth periods and you start saying, should I use 5, should I use 10, should I use 15, especially with these promising companies, Box, right? It's going to go public sooner or later. You know what Box does? It basically provides you the storage space. It's the fastest growing young company out there. It's the quickest, I think, to $1 billion in revenues of any of those companies, including Uber. You say, well, that's a great company. I'm going to use a long growth period. And you say 5, 10. I'm going to show you a graph that might, I'll show it to you later, okay, that might sober you up on the growth periods, but just be cautious about not allowing for these extended growth periods, which you cannot deliver. And remember, it's not growth that drives value. It's what kind of returns on capital you can make with that growth rate, right? So if you can grow for 50 years or 80 years, it's not going to create value unless you earn a return on capital greater than the cost of capital. In the first session, I talked about narratives, qualitative analysis, knowing what a business does, knowing what its competition is. This is the place it shows up. The stronger and more sustainable the competitive advantages for your company. So there is a use for that corporate strategy class you took, right? So if you can make it practical, here's where it comes in. Think about the competitive advantages. Think it through the process. Because if you believe your company has strong and sustainable competitive advantages, the way it shows up is as a higher return on capital, and you can essentially give them a longer growth period because of that. So when you think about putting your company into stable growth, that's what you're thinking about. Don't think about what the growth rate was last year, how promising things look. Ask yourself what the competitive advantages of this company are. So whether it's Uber or Box, this is a question that's tough to answer, right? This is a young company. You're saying, what will their competitive advantages be? But unless you grapple with that question, it's going to be very difficult for you to come up with a sensible value for your company. In fact, let's take Uber. What do you think its competitive advantage is going to be? We know right now it's a first player in many of these. It's in more cities. But think through the game. 5 years out, you've got all these car-sharing companies. What's going to make, if you think Uber is going to be the special one, where its competitive advantage is going to come from?
Capital.
One is capital, which is obviously play. The problem, though, is with capital, and I was talking to somebody from Uber very high up last week, he was complaining that there's too much capital coming into young startups. You know why he's complaining? Because Lyft just got an influx of capital, and using the capital, Lyft is cutting prices in L.A. If you've taken Uber in L.A., it's 92 cents a mile, which is obscenely low. Which is, you drive 45 minutes in L.A. in a taxi, in Uber it costs you $28. That guy is not even, but Lyft has come in because, so Capital gain is an advantage if you have it and nobody else does. So Uber's down in these pranks, say, tomorrow, let the bubble burst, let nobody else be able to get capital, because they've got $3 billion in capital, that makes them... But capital is a dangerous game. You have $3 billion in capital, you think that's your advantage? Yeah. How much does Apple have? $170 billion. There are players with a lot more cash in their pockets. So if that's their advantage, then it's going to wither away. All you need is a big player like Google to come into the game with electric cars, throw $10 billion in, and there goes your capital advantage. Brand, and they're working on it, right? And in terms of car sharing, what's the brand thing? Is you hit that app, it's midnight, you're in the corner, you could be mugged at any time. You want the car to get there within 5 minutes. Oh, my God, where is it? So part of the branding is it reliable? And part of the reason those stories over the last 6 months you've heard about Uber are so troubling is if you decide that part of the brand is you want a nice, safe ride, you might say those stories are making me... It might be unfair to Uber, but they have to deal with it. They have to deal with it really quickly because if it undercuts that advantage they have. What else? And let's be specific. What exactly, how will this show up? First, what are network effects? What does that mean?
So it's like the value of any incremental user is not just the value of the user itself, but the value that's added.
The more users you have, it actually gets easier to get additional users, right? The classic incremental effects is if you think about eBay. Network effect is you want to go where everybody else is because otherwise what are you going to get from auctioning an item? So that's a classic network benefit.
A lot more cars,
you have a lot more drivers. So basically, there is that network effect. But is it a local network effect or a global network effect? It's a local network effect, which means you've got to fight this out city by city. It could be Uber in New York and Lyft in L.A., which actually will affect how much you value the company at, because it'll mean what... So think through these things, because it might be qualitative, but it's going to determine how long you let this company grow, what kind of return on capital you give it, and what you will do to this company when you make it a steady state company. So it is true that there are some firms that earn excess returns. Yes, Joseph?
So if you're talking about markets that are still developing and a company that's still developing its brand, how would you give it or take away from it?
Let me ask you a question. Does Trevor Kalanick know the answer to that question, you think? No, nobody does. That's what all I'm saying is we're all in a state of uncertainty. You have to make your best judgment with the information you have in front of you. That's all you can do. If you put the weight of the world on your shoulders and say, I have to get this right, you're never going to complete the valuation. You're right. It's a lot of uncertainty. You have to make judgments. But if you wait till things settle down to make your judgment, everybody will know by that, right? So this is part of the process of being first into these young companies, is whether you're thinking through this process a little more seriously than everybody else, and I'll tell you your biggest advantage. Why are most people investing in Uber? Is it because they've thought through these networking benefits? It's because they want to be there when it goes public. They're in there like sheep. For the same reason that sheep are there, because the other sheep are there. And if it's going to go public, they don't want to be left out. And it is true, we're working with very little, but we're working against people who are working with nothing at all. So it's, you have to do the best you can, and you're going to be wrong. And you know what the best way to deal with being wrong is? Don't put all your money in Uber. Have 20, and it's a diversification. The classic reasons for diversification actually get stronger when you have companies like Uber. Because it's hubris to say, I know Uber is going to be the winner. I'm going to put all my money in Uber. How do you know? Right? So everything we talk about in the context of diversification becomes, you have to talk about it in spades when you have a company like Uber. Right? And in fact, the reason I brought up this issue of return on capital is McKinsey actually has a very specific, it's pretty dogmatic. When you get to steady state, a mature company, mature companies are required to earn a return on capital equal to the cost of capital. So in McKinsey valuations, there is no growth in the terminal value. So if you look at the McKinsey book, which actually came out about the same time as my first valuation book, you look at the terminal value equation, it's NOPLAT, which is McKinsey's version of after-tax operating income. It's EBIT times 1 minus T divided by cost of capital. There's no G. So for the first 15 years or so when the McKinsey book was out, people would email me saying, how come there's no G in the terminal value equation in the McKinsey book? To which my response is, why aren't you emailing McKinsey? Right? But we had the same publisher, so they must have thought we all hung out together somewhere. You know? And the answer is very simple. If you read the rest of the chapter, they're very specific. And this is built into McKinsey DCF spreadsheets. Is once you get to steady state, your return on capital is equal to the cost of capital. And when the return on capital is equal to the cost of capital, what do we say happens to the value of growth? It goes away. There is no, so might as well use a zero growth rate because you get the same terminal values using a 2% or a 3% growth rate. The only problem is McKinsey itself has some research that undercuts that assumption. It comes from a magazine called McKinsey Quarterly, which is actually one of my favorite magazines to read because it's free. Get on the McKinsey website, register. They do a lot of applied corporate finance and valuation work. So here's an example of a paper that they did. So these are McKinsey consultants. They get together. They look at what the return on capital is for companies is relative to the cost of capital. Does it go to the cost of capital like they assume in the McKinsey? They looked across companies, and they found that while growth rates converge in the growth rate of the economy, in other words, the assumption that growth goes to the risk-free rate is a reasonable assumption, that the returns on capital of companies actually stayed above the cost of capital for decades. So that's why I said I'm not dogmatic. If you showed me a company and said, in this company, I think the return on capital is going to stay above the cost of capital, I think McKinsey's own research backs it up. If you're valuing a brand name company or an infrastructure company, that it's okay to assume the return on capital is above the cost of capital, even though your growth hits the stable growth rate in 5 years or 10 years. But think through that, because I think that that's an issue we run into, and we've already dealt with this earlier, but there are times you'll be told that this is a special company. The cash flows are growing at the inflation rate, and that all you're doing is replacing old CapEx with new CapEx. You're maintaining capacity, so it's okay for CapEx to offset depreciation. Net CapEx is zero. I think it's hard-coded into some investment banking DCFs. CapEx equal to depreciation is hard-coded in the terminal value. The reason, of course, it doesn't work is if inflation is helping you when you sell stuff to people, guess what? It's hurting you when you replace old assets, which effectively means that even when the growth rate is equal to the inflation rate, you can't get away assuming that net CapEx is zero. So that's something that you constantly have to check your terminal value on. Final stop of the process, check all your numbers to make sure you're internally consistent. I've used this valuation triangle analogy before. Valuation triangle, you have three sides of the triangle. You have cash flows, growth, and risk, and I said they have to be consistent. So if you have a high growth company, you tend to have high growth, high reinvestment, high risk. You make it a mature company, which is what you're in steady state, you have low growth. You have the reinvestment to go with that low growth, which is low reinvestment. But you also have to give the company the cost of capital of a mature company. So if you have a cost of capital of 12% or 15% right now, it's a risky company, don't leave that cost of capital at 12 to 15% once you make the company a stable company, because as it becomes mature, its cost of capital will have to converge on that of a mature company. So it's not just the growth rate that changes, it's everything else. And the reinvestment assumption that you make in steady state has to be consistent with your growth rate and the return on capital you're assuming for the company. So that's the last big number in the valuation. So think about it. You've got cash flows, you've got growth rates, you've got discount rates, and you've got the terminal value. Those four numbers will be embedded in every discounted cash flow valuation. So here's how I'm going to bring this to closure. I know that you haven't started the DCF for your company. I know. I just know this in my stomach. In fact, I know some of you haven't even picked the company to do your DCF on. You've thought about the company. You've gotten very close. You almost touched the company, but you haven't got that. So, but somewhere in the next 3 weeks, you will have to do a DCF. And you're going to go back and look through your notes, and you're going to be bamboozled by all the different DCF models. Which model do I use? So I want to take you through a very quick journey through all of these different models and talk about how you pick the right DCF model for your company. Notice how I phrased it. I didn't say the right DCF model, period, because there is no one model that fits every company. So part of this process of evaluation is picking the right company, picking the right model. So at this stage in the process, we have cash flows, we have a discount rate, we have a growth rate. You have to decide what cash flow you want to discount. What are your choices? You can discount dividends. You can discount free cash flow to equity. You can discount free cash flow to the firm. What are your choices on discount rates? You can use cost of equity. You can use cost of capital. What are your choices on growth? You can have stable growth already, in which case you're done in 5 minutes. You can have a high growth period and then stable growth, a high growth period and a transition phase, or a growth rate that varies every year. So if you think about it, your choices are in front of you, and the question is, how do you bring these choices together? So here's the first thing to think about. Should I value the business, or should I value equity in the business? Do you see the first fork in the road you come to? Should I value the business? Should I value? When we started this process, what did I say? If you do it right, what happens? You get the same value. So this is a pragmatic choice. Which is going to be easier to do? Is it easier to value the business or value equity? To value the business, what do you need? You need free cash flows to the firm, right? Which are pre-debt cash flows. To value equity, you need cash flows after debt payments, which are after interest payments and principal payments. So we went through that free cash flow to equity computation a couple of sessions ago. And there were two ways I computed. One was this long way where I had to figure out principal repayments and new debt issues. But I also gave you a shortcut, right? Where you took the net capex times 1 minus the debt ratio. And to use the shortcut, what did I say you had to assume? Stable debt. There's the tiebreaker. If you have a company where you look at the debt ratio and you're okay with it being the debt ratio forever, and it's going to be a relatively small number of companies, then free cash or equity works fine. But if you have changing debt ratios, doing free cash or equity becomes a nightmare. See, when would debt ratios change? Well, either you have a company with very little debt now that you expect to increase its debt ratio over time, or a company like Petrobras, which has a huge amount of debt that has to decrease its debt ratio, you're better off valuing the firm. So the first fork in the road, ask yourself, does this company have stable leverage? If it has stable leverage, you can do an equity valuation. If it doesn't, you're better off valuing the entire business. Let's say you decide to go the equity route. What are your two choices? You can value based on dividends, or you can value based on free cash flow equity. Let me take away one of those choices. If you can estimate free cash flow equity, never ever use a dividend discount model. It's lazy, it's sloppy, and it'll leave you with some strange numbers for companies. Let me take Berkshire Hathaway. The dividend discount model, what's the value of equity? Zero. The company's never paid a dividend. Absurd, right? But that's because you're taking the easy way out. You're looking at the dividend. If you cannot compute free cash flow equity, then you can say, I have no choice. I have to use the dividend discount model. You say, when would that be? What do I need to compute free cash flow equity? I need to start with net income. Then I need capex minus depreciation. I need debt ratio, and I need change in working capital, right? I can always do that. I have the financial statements in front of me. When are you going to have the most difficulty coming up with net capex, change in working capital, and debt ratio? Private company, you might have a little difficulty, but as long as you have the full financials for a private company, I can do it. But if you have a bank or an insurance company, it's a nightmare. Try it. So already I give you the last vestiges of the dividend discount model. It's because you had no choice. Use the dividend discount model because you could not estimate free cash or equity. That used to be my defense for using the dividend discount model for banks until 2008. I no longer use that defense. I have to come up with a different answer now. But that was the reason I said, you know what, I'm using the dividend discount model because I have no choice. If you can estimate the free cash or equity, just use it. It's potential dividend. You're saying, but I had to make assumptions to get there. It's a cash flow. Right? It's right there in the statement of cash flows. So if you take the equity branch, then look at whether you can estimate free cash flow equity. If you can estimate free cash flow equity, go with the free cash flows to equity. So firm versus equity, which one do you pick? Whether your debt ratio is stable or not. If you go the equity route, dividends versus free cash flow equity, you can follow through on that branch. Now, once you decide to do a firm or an equity valuation, your discount rate kind of comes out of that choice, right? Because if you're estimating cash flows to equity, whether it's dividends or free cash flow to equity, your discount rate always has to be a cost of equity. If your cash flows are pre-debt cash flows, your discount rate has to be a cost of capital. If your cash flows are in one currency, your discount rate is going to be in exactly the same currency. And if you decide to go real, in other words, take inflation out, make sure your discount rate is also real. So you estimate cash flows. Your discount rate has to match up. It's not even a choice. You choose the cash flow, your discount rate gets chosen for you. Which brings me to that growth question. Let's say you're valuing, anybody here valuing Toyota? No. Coca-Cola, McDonald's. The reason I bring these up, but these are companies where you're stretching to find any reason to give them high growth anymore. McDonald's just reported declining revenues on same store. So in a sense, this is a company, at best case scenario, you might be looking at 1% growth, maybe 1.5% growth, even in nominal terms. You just hit the jackpot in your valuation. Why? Because if you have a company growing at less than the growth rate of the economy already, what can you assume? That it's already a mature company, in which case you need only three numbers to value the company, right? Cash flows next year, cost of capital, growth rate, you're done. No spreadsheet needed. You could probably do it in the back of an envelope right now and say, I'm done with my valuation. Can you take a look at it? Don't do it now. But, no. But if you have a company that is growing at less than the growth rate of the economy, it's a mature company, it has a cost of capital that reflects at maturity, you can essentially use a stable growth model. You don't need to wait till year 10 to compute terminal value. You can do it right now, and that'll be the value today. If you have a company with any growth, and we talked about, you know, some reason to believe that a company might have rediscovered growth with low interest rates, give them a growth window where you allow them to earn a higher return on capital and a higher growth rate. This could be the case, if you have emerging market growth, is you can say this company has rediscovered its youth, at least temporarily. Give them a high growth window and then drop them off to stable growth. That's a two-stage model. If you have a company where the growth rate is 30, 40, 50%, you probably have to have a transition phase. You know what I mean by transition phase? It's not going to go from 50 to 2 overnight. You might say over a 3 or a 4 year period, I'm going to let the growth decline. So basically, when you think about growth, those are your choices. You're either already in stable growth, you have a temporary high growth phase followed by stable growth, or you have growth kind of changing over time. So I think of this as the equivalent of playing in a Lego box. It's been a long time since we played with Lego. But you know, if you take Lego pieces and you try to fit them together and they don't go together, you can try for the rest of eternity, but they're never going to fit. But basically, there are three pieces, three compartments in my Lego box. There's the cash flow Lego, there's the discount rate Lego, and the growth Lego. You put them together, you got a DCF model. So you can take either cash flow to equity, cash flow to the firm. You haven't seen these Legos? Maybe I should create these Legos so people can try them in valuation. But every DCF model is just a collection of those three pieces. And if you try to force a cost of equity with a cash flow to the firm piece, things are going to start breaking. So every discounted cash flow model is just a collection of the assumptions you make of cash flows, growth, and risk. Take a look at your company to make a judgment on which one best fits your company. Yes, any questions? Joseph. Well, remember, that right now, U.S. dollar risk-free rate is 2.25%, right? So let's say you're sitting down to value Procter & Gamble. And based on the reinvestment rate, you come up with 4%. It's not a high growth rate, but it's still higher than 2.25%, right? So when you're talking about 4%, 5% growth, you're talking about growth that's close enough to the risk-free rate that you can bring it down to the risk-free rate without huge consequences. I'll tell you when it'll be 10%. Is let's say you have a pharmaceutical company with one blockbuster drug that's creating growth and it's going to expire in 5 years or 7 years. You know, the minute the drug goes, the growth goes with it. That'll be a classic example, a license or a patent, something expiring that basically said that happens, then I'm going to bring the growth rate down to stable growth. I know we're reaching towards the end of the session, but I want to at least get started on the next piece, which is what I call the loose sense in valuation. Sounds like a funny thing to say. But at this point, think of where we are. We have cash flows. We've discounted the cost of capital. We come up with the present value. This is what the heart of discounted cash flow valuation is, right? But it's amazing how much stuff happens after you tell me you're done. It's what I call the loose sense. It's all the stuff you do after you tell me you're done. And I'll give you the genesis for this particular portion of the presentation. I work incredibly hard. I teach like 4.5 hours a week. I get I get only 5 months off every year. But because I work so hard, every seventh year I get the whole year off with pay. It's called a sabbatical. You guys probably have something similar in your jobs, right? No, I don't think so. People complain. When you hear academics complain about, they have no idea what the real world looks like. But about 9 years ago, I had a sabbatical. That actually reminds me, I have another sabbatical coming due that I should have taken 2 years ago. I should get back and check on this. But about 9 years ago, I have a sabbatical. And people have these huge plans for sabbaticals. They're going to write a book. They're going to go here. But I had a singular vision on my sabbatical. Here's what I wanted to do. I wanted to wake up an entire year with nothing to do. So my sabbatical arrives, and I'm very ostentatious about it, probably two. So I settle in my house. I buy a to-do list from Staples. I put it above my little corner of my room where I, you know, hang out at home. And here's where I think I got over the line. So my kids come down to go to school, and I point to my to-do list and, look, I have nothing to do today. Piss them off now. And, okay? And then I made my fatal mistake. My wife came down, and I said, "Hun, I have nothing to do today." She said, "Really?" And then I wander off. I take the dogs out for a walk. I come back, and there's something on my to-do list. I said, "What the heck happened here? A whole year, nothing to do, something?" She says, "Pick up bok choy at the grocery store." I didn't even know what bok choy looked like. I was too embarrassed to ask. I spent 2 hours wandering around the grocery store looking for bok choy. I didn't even know which section to look at. Is it livestock? Is it not? It turns out to be ugly-looking cabbage. But after I find it, I come back and says, "Pick up kids at school." So it's all these items showing up. So after about the fifth or sixth item showing up in my to-do list, I start to get desperate to put things to do on my to-do list to keep my wife away from my list. So I said, I need somebody to give me something to do. So I get this email from the editor of CFA magazine. I didn't even know there was a magazine called CFA magazine. So, "Will you write an article for the magazine, a one-page article?" My usual response is, "Are you kidding me? I'm on sabbatical." But then I did remember I needed something for my to-do list. I said, "Oh, yeah, I'll write it." So in big letters on my to-do list, I said, "Write article for CFA magazine, cannot pick up bok choy kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." So I sit down to write the article, and I have to tell you, it took me a day to write the article, but it's the only thing I've ever written in my life that's got me hate mail. You know how difficult it is to get hate mail in valuation? People don't feel strongly enough. "I hate you for using bottom-up betas. I hate you for using implied premiums." Never happens. But this one actually got me some hate mail. Part of it was the title of the article. It said, "Stop the Garnishing." And I was talking about the process in valuation where people will be done with the valuation and then they would start to garnish. In what sense? They would add 20% for control, knock off 15% for liquidity, add 30% for synergy. I said, "You got to stop this, because if you do this, you're going to back into a number you wanted in the first place." So the wave of hate mail starts coming in. I might have used the word arbitrary somewhere so arbitrary premiums and discounts, all these appraisers started writing me, "How dare you call it arbitrary? We have this research that shows that the discount should be 28%. Strange samples of crazy companies, but I guess it's some kind of study anyway. But one of the emails actually struck home. It said, "If you think what we're doing in valuation is so wrong, why don't you come up with a better way of doing it?" Because I'm not saying control is not worth value. I'm not sure why it's always 20%. I'm not saying liquidity doesn't matter, but why is it always 30%? So I said, "You know what? You're right. I have 11 months left in my sabbatical, and here's what I'm going to do. Each month, I'm going to pick up a loose end. And I'm going to spend the month thinking about how I would deal with that loose end." You're saying, like what? First month I dealt with liquidity. The next was control. So basically all these big things that people attach premiums or discounts for. It's actually one half of one of my books now. It's De Modern and Valuation, second edition. The second half of the book is my sabbatical year. It's basically 9 loose ends, each of which I kind of dealt with as a chapter. In fact, you don't have to buy the book, because I took the chapters, made them into quasi-papers. I didn't even really fix anything. I just called it, give it a different title. So that way the publisher doesn't know that the whole chapter is on. Okay. So you go in and type in value of control, you get chapter 11 of the book. So I took out any word chapter. In fact, I did find and replace in Microsoft Word. I find word chapter, replace with paper. It's amazing how quickly chapters disappear, papers show up, right? So you can get those that sabbatical year kind of play out on. But that's what the loose ends are. So on Wednesday, what we're going to do is we're going to spend time on those loose ends. And here are some of the things we're going to talk about. What's the value of cash? So we've dealt with that already. Cash is cash, is it? You have $1 billion in cash in the hands of a company. Would you sometimes discount the cash in the hands of some companies and attach a premium in others? I think so. We'll talk about that. We're going to talk about cross-holdings. We're going to talk about other assets that you might want to bring into your valuation. You have a headquarters building in Tokyo or Beijing or Shanghai that's gone up in value. Should you be adding the value of the real estate to your discounted cash flow valuation? So we're going to go through a series of loose ends and talk about tying them up. But we're going to use the process from discounted cash flow evaluation to reason our way to how best to deal with these loose ends. So I'll see you on Wednesday.